Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Heck, President and Founder of the International Association of Teamwork Facilitators. Today is July 14th, 2011. The time is 1:01 p.m. Eastern, and you have dialed in to the monthly IATF Leadership Skills and Faculty Member Call that we hold monthly. And our topic today is the Tao and leadership and teamwork. And my guest is Steve Simpson, who I'm going to introduce here momentarily. I do want to mention that today's call does include the opportunity to view a web interface. It's called the Participant Dashboard. You were sent a link to this in the information, the same place that you found the phone number to dial in. You'll have that link, and you'll be able to type questions or comments, and then also participate in polling. If you don't have the participant dashboard or access to that, that's all okay. It's just a value add, and it's a kind of a fun thing. A little bit about the IATF. We provide teachings, tools, and community for the evolution of team consciousness. And we do we promote this by holding calls like this one, group coaching, products, and providing community for people in 35 countries. All people who are working to build or evolve the thinking of teams and how we work together. Our web address is www.iatfconnect.com. And a little bit about our guest today is Professor Steve Simpson, who is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He works in the Department of Recreation Management and Therapeutic Recreation. He is the former editor of the Journal of Experiential Education, and he has written over 50 articles on experiential education, outdoor recreation, and environmental ethics. And his books include The Processing Pinnacle, An Educator's Guide to Better Processing, and the book that we're going to be discussing today, which is The Leader Who is Hardly Known, Selfless Teaching from the Chinese Tradition, and that was published in 2003. Steve, welcome to the call.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so I've been enjoying your book, and I'd like to start off our call today with a comment that you make on just page two here, and you write that about the experiential educator's dilemma, and I'm wondering if you can basically share what you view the dilemma that all of us are facing as experiential educators. And I should mention that I view if you're a good teacher, a good facilitator, a good trainer, that all of us are engaging people in some way experientially. And so, what is this dilemma that you talk about?
Sure. The book is, I don't want to say based on this dilemma, but it's the notion of finding the balance between how much the facilitator or the teacher controls what's going on, with the idea that he or she knows more than what the students do, or ought to know more than what the students do, and versus turning the participants loose to explore on their own. The dilemma is partly based on the fact that perhaps the facilitators, especially if they don't know the participants that well, may not have a good a sense of what the participants need as they think, and may be taking folks off in an incorrect direction. One that might be worthwhile, and based on their experiences, has benefited other folks. But as much as we try to find out what's going on before we actually start our programs, we don't always know what people know best. And so is it just turning kids, I should say kids, I work mostly with university students and children, turning the students loose or controlling the environment and the activities. I live really close to a marsh, and I compare the difference between when I take my students to the marsh and when I take my daughter to the marsh. And they're both having great experiences. They're both learning a lot. But with my students, I tend to control what we're going to look at. Mm-hmm. And with my daughter, it's whatever she's interested in is what we pursue. And they're both learning things, but learning different things.
So There's a mixture of people I know from looking at the names in front of me here on the screen and what people have written, comments that people have left around what they do in the world as far as, you know, maybe they're a coach or a trainer and they're work or a facilitator of some kind, and they either work for themselves or maybe they work for a large organization. And so we've got a mixture of people here today. I'm wondering if you can help us understand who this book, The Leader Who Is Hardly Known, who did you write it for, really?
Well, most specifically, I wrote it. I said I would, as you said in my introduction, that I was a former editor for the Journal of Experiential Education, and which is the Association for Experiential Education is the one that publishes that. And for the most part, their folks are wilderness trip leaders, ropes course facilitators, some corporate trainers, but a lot of it is outdoor-based. And my background is actually in environmental education. So when I originally wrote the book, I had those folks in mind, and a lot of the examples in the book are based on environmental education and outdoor recreation.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that these ideas are much broader than that. But when I took on the project, there were other books, I think, that touched on that already. Tao of Leadership is one example where the author took each of the 81 chapters of the Tao Te Ching and tweaked it for leadership more in a business community. And so I specifically aimed at this outdoor audience because I felt that that was one group that hadn't been introduced to the Tao by other Western writers.
And in fact, my background is I worked in an outdoor leadership, a wilderness therapy program serving adjudicated kids who were actually in jail, if you will. And it was a pre-release program, and that's where I had a lot of my introduction to experiential learning, and have since, I still work with kids occasionally, but do a lot more work with adults, and a lot of work with adults who work with kids. So when I read this book, I saw a lot that really touched me. So and was applicable in my life. So let me ask you this. There was a comment about, and I'm going to read this, that someone left when they were registering for the call. And he writes, this was Vaughn, and he writes, as a rough estimate, what percentage of the people you train are asking, in quotations, higher questions and showing an interest in connecting spiritually at or through their work? And so this has sort of got me wondering about, what is the Tao? Is the Tao a spiritual practice, or is it a religion? Or help us understand where this falls in the realm of spirituality and religion.
That's a perfect opening question, I think. Matter of fact, my publisher, Wooden Barnes Publishing, just hired a consultant, and one of the things that he was doing was looking at some of our older titles, including my book about the Tao, and seeing if they could have been marketed differently. And his comment to this particular book was that the spiritual component is a plus and a minus, and that among some circles, that people will grab the book because it has a spiritual component, and then others, particularly in formal education, particularly public education, that may actually hurt the book in terms of marketability.
Mm-hmm.
My response to him was, I was a little bit surprised by the comment at all, because I didn't think of it as a particularly spiritual book. And the reason I say that, in an answer to your question, is that Taoism is actually two fairly distinct things. There is a religion, and I lived in Taiwan for a number of years, and the most interesting temples to visit as far as a tourist are certainly the Taoist temples. They're the most colorful and the most active, as opposed to a more sedate Buddhist temple, for example. And there is a religion, and out of that religion comes some of the kung fu movies and other things that people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the philosophy of Tao, which is almost entirely a separate thing. And there's many, many volumes written in Chinese about the Tao, the Tao Te Ching being the most famous, and another book called the Zhuangzi, which is the second most important book. And those are strictly philosophical works. To me, no more spiritual than if you were reading Aristotle or Plato. And certainly there's spiritual components. A big part of the Tao is humility, for example, and obviously there's a spiritual component to that. But to specifically link it to a religion or a higher spiritual level, that's not the way that I interpret it anyway.
Actually, let's do a quick poll here. I'm curious as to where everybody else sees this and coming to this call today. Using your telephone keypad and the numbers 1 through 5, rate where you see what do you associate with the Tao? Do you one would be if you hit your one key on your telephone keypad is very low on the spiritual spectrum, and 5 is for you. You associate at least the Tao with being very spiritual, the teaching. So just out of curiosity, go ahead and hit your keys. And Steve, are you able to see the results?
Yep,
of this?
I'm looking at that. And it's
yeah,
kind of a lot of fours are right now. Yep.
Yeah,
it's pretty much all over the place, though.
It is.
Yeah.
So does that surprise you? I mean, when you talk to people about leadership and team building and the lessons that the Tao has to teach us, do most people bring in this piece about spirituality?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I said it more strongly than I wanted to. For me, the spiritual component is the strong connection with nature in the
mm-hmm.
same way that Thoreau or Emerson. Matter of fact, they cite, you know, Eastern philosophy quite a bit. The notion that nature is the way, or that nature has lessons to teach humanity,
mm-hmm.
and the more that a human being can be open to nature, and the more that a human being lives his or her life in accordance with nature, is the right path to take, and obviously that has a spiritual component to it.
I was going to say that I developed a training, I was either 3 or 4 days long, for the North Carolina Department of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and ran this at different times across the state of North Carolina. And I'll never forget, Steve, that I put in all this effort to create a really great program for these folks, and towards the end of this multi-day training, what I did is I had the ability to use different conference facilities. Is I simply asked people to go out for an hour and sit by themselves with nothing to write on or nothing to read, and no phones or anything like that, and just sit for an hour in nature, right? And we're just at a conference facility, and I kid you not, the thing that most people remember and the most powerful piece about the whole thing was that hour. here I am putting in all this effort, and all it took to get a really great experience for many of them, for most, was to sit quietly by themselves in nature. And so as you talk about this piece about what does nature have to teach us, and of course, people came back and shared what was going, happening for them and this type of thing. So that the whole sharing process, I still sort of laugh at that, and I think about my own desire to maybe overcomplicate things.
Well, as you were talking, it made me think. I teach one of my classes that I teach here at the university is a sort of an introductory outdoor recreation course, and we do solo sits occasionally, and the most common comment we get after that is that, And these are a lot of the students that come to my university are they're the first generation to go to college. Some of them grew up on farms, mostly small towns, and their comment almost always is that they did this a lot when they were kids and kind of lost it during high school and haven't done it since. And it was a reminder like, oh yeah, this is a wonderful thing to be doing, and they had forgotten. And these are folks that are only, you know, 20, 21 years old, and they've already forgotten. And so I'm not surprised by the fact that that was the highlight of all the work you put into it to give them some time alone in nature.
Right. Well, so this sort of reflects back on the title. Maybe we can jump back to the book, your book, The Leader Who is Hardly Known, and the subtitle, Selfless Teaching from the Chinese Tradition. So maybe we can start there. What is The Leader Who is Hardly Known? Tell us about this leader and where you came up
sure.
with that.
Well, there's two things that are probably worth mentioning. One is that, and you said you've read parts of the book, so you know this, that each chapter begins with a hypothetical anecdote about a leader whose leadership style is to remain in the background. Mm-hmm. And within all those chapters, this leader is referred to as the leader who is hardly known. But the name or that phrasing is not mine. It's from the Tao Te Ching. And folks that are listening, I don't know how familiar you are with the Tao Te Ching, but it's an ancient text. There's a really good. You want to hear a great story about how the book maybe got written? I don't know.
And this is how old is the book?
Well, I got a great story for that too. But it was written. It was written. Lao Tzu and Confucius, who are the two great Chinese philosophers, lived at exactly the same time as Aristotle and Plato. So it's like the planet was ready for this intellectual leap, and it happened in China at the same time it was happening in Europe. And so Lao Tzu, if he did exist, and there's some argument whether or not he really existed, if he did exist, if there is such a person, then he lived exactly at the same time as Aristotle and Plato. The story of how this book was written, and it's very short, 81 chapters, but each chapter is only a page long. The story is that Lao Tzu was a great teacher in this kingdom. At the time, China was divided into smaller kingdoms, and Lao Tzu was the great teacher. He was an advisor to the emperor of this kingdom, and one day he just decided it was time to leave. And so he walks away, and to leave the kingdom he has to cross a river, and the only way to get across the river is to find the ferryman to take him across. And the ferryman is about to let him on the ferry, and he goes, "Hey, wait a minute, are you Lao Tzu?" And Lao Tzu goes, "Yes." And he goes, "Where are you going?" And Lao Tzu says, "I don't know." And the ferryman says, "Are you coming back?" And Lao Tzu says, "I don't know." And the ferryman says, "Well, then I'm not going to charge you to take you across, but before you leave, you have to write down your teachings." And so Lao Tzu went back and wrote the Tao Te Ching and gave it to the ferryman, and the ferryman took him across. And that's how his ideas supposedly got down on paper. So it's a good legend, and probably not true, but it's still a good story.
Yeah, I love it.
But in reference to the Tao Te Ching, one of the chapters, many of the chapters talk about leadership, but there's one of the chapters that says there's four kinds of leaders. There's the leader who is hardly known, which is best. The second best is the leader who is loved and praised. And then it degenerates to the leader who's basically a dictator who everybody hates but is afraid to act against. But the point being that, in his mind, the best leader is the leader who is hardly known. And the very end of chapter 17, it says, the best leader is the one who, when everything gets done, the people say, "Oh, we did it by ourselves."
Mm-hmm.
With the idea that the most effective leader is the one who sets everything up, makes things happen, but the perception and the effort is mostly done by the participants, So when they do get done, they almost say, well, we didn't need that guy there anyway because we did it all on our own.
And I do want to jump off from there and to talk about humility here, because I know that you have said that that's actually early on in the book you write about humility. And but I do want to offer to everyone else is that you can write a question or a comment to Steve or myself through the participant dashboard. And you can also raise your electronic hand, if you will, by just pushing the one key on your telephone keypad. And I can see it on this end that your hand is up next to your name. And then I can call on you and pass you the mic so that you can ask a question directly. I will mention that Ed Nottingham says that sounds like Jim Collins' concept of the level five leader in the mentioning of humility. So I think that for many who are who would read Steve's book is that if you're familiar with other leadership books, you're going to find crossover, which is very interesting and exciting to me, because we're looking at really old, ancient thoughts about leadership. So, Steve, tell us about your this first piece around humility, because I underlined this. It says, if there is a best first step toward being a leader who is hardly known, and I guess this is assuming that this is the best kind of leader, it is becoming, in order to get there, you have to become genuinely humble. So maybe we should start with that question. Is the leader who is hardly known, in your estimation, Steve, the best leader in all situations? Or when do we who are on this call, when do we begin to strive to live like this or lead like this?
Sure.
Is it sometimes or all the time?
Well, I'm a proponent of situational leadership, so I would say not all the time. But at the same time, there's, let's say each of us has a leadership persona or personality, mm-hmm. The leader who is hardly known is, if you abide by the Tao Te Ching and Zhuangzi, by the way. And I should point out that both those books are, to me, surprisingly accessible. If you find a good English translation, they're not written mysteriously, or they're not written using philosophical terms that only philosophers understand. To me, they're a series of stories that are very accessible. And in fact, and you can cut me off when I start telling too many stories out of these classics, when you mention humility, one of the best stories is the legend of Monkey Mountain. And the story is that the emperor was with his entourage on barges cruising down the river, and suddenly the emperor says, pull ashore, I want to take you to Monkey Mountain. And so they pull ashore, and the emperor and his friends and his guards and all these folks walk through the jungle until they get to a place called Monkey Mountain. And it's named that because it's just, the trees are just filled with monkeys. And as soon as the people arrive, all of the monkeys disappear into the treetops, except one monkey goes out on a branch low down and starts taunting the emperor. The emperor grabs a bow and arrow and shoots at the monkey, but the monkey pulls the arrow right out of the air and throws it back down at the emperor. Immediately, the emperor orders his archers to shoot the monkey, and of course, there's just 30, 40 arrows in the air simultaneously. The monkey can't catch them all, and he falls dead to the ground. The emperor goes and picks up the dead monkey and hands it to a friend of his and said, this happened to this monkey because he was not humble. Now you go home and practice humility. And this particular individual, who is a friend of the emperor's, goes home and basically disappears for 2 years, working on his humility, and becomes more famous than he ever would have been in his old way, because he's known throughout the kingdom as as this humble soul.
You know, when I read that story and the story that follows it, it reminded me of a program that I had the opportunity to work with some MBA students, some students enrolled in a 2-year MBA program, and I was facilitating a team of 10, and then at one point during the day, we were asked to divide the team of 10 into sub-teams of 5, and this was this team of 5. These were students that were going to work together in team exercises throughout that first year of their time at this, and this was a large, famous university MBA program. And something interesting happened, and it reminded me of this, is we were asked, I asked all of the participants to create they were all given some markers, colorful markers, and a large piece of paper, and they divided the large piece of paper into 4 quadrants. And one of the quadrants, they were asked to draw their view of what, a metaphoric picture, if you will, of what they believe their team should be about. And everyone on the team, of this team of 5, was from born and raised in North America, or here in the U.S. And then there was one student from, I think, Taiwan. And so everybody had an opportunity to share what each of these quadrants. But when it came to the Taiwanese student, he was the last one that went, that shared his. And Steve, his picture was so different than everybody else's. All the other students, again, born and raised in the United States, they had pictures of like mountains with a flag at the top, and you know, an eagle soaring above all these other birds, and you know, things like that. Essentially, communicating our team will be best.
Right.
We're going to have the best team. And then this student shares his. Now he's going to be on this team with these 4 other guys. And these are all guys, for a whole year. And he says, here's what I think our team should be about. And he had a hammer hitting a nail that was sticking out, a 5th nail that was sticking out, so that all the nails were even in the board. And yeah, you're laughing, I guess, because you can tell where he was coming from. Essentially, his belief is that we should all blend in. And here he is on a team of guys who are saying we should all rise above and be the best of everyone else. And so it's sort of the reverse of the monkey here, in that he's there's a lot of people who want to stand out and be boastful. And so what in this situation, what is a community like that to do? What does the Tao have to teach us?
Well, one thing that, as you were talking, the first thing that came to mind to me was that, Zhuangzi in particular, I think, is pretty explicit about this, is that humility, you were saying, can anybody be a humble leader? And the response from the Tao would be that only the mature leader can really be humble, for a couple reasons. One is that it's something that people need to consciously work on, that most of us are prideful, and that humility is not a trait you acquire. It's defined as getting rid of pridefulness. And so as you get rid of pride, then you become humble. The other is that people need to reach a point in their career, in their work, where they trust their abilities to the point that they don't need external recognition for their efforts. The leader who is hardly known doesn't get much recognition because people say, oh, he or she didn't do anything. And that will only come when someone's been at things for enough years to have probably received enough, you know, recognition, confirmation that what they're doing is good work. And that they, one, they don't need the recognition. 2, when it comes their way, they can divert it or pass it on to someone else, a colleague perhaps, or even maybe someone under them that would benefit from having that kind of recognition. And so there is a level of maturity that is required before, at least in the Tao sense, before humility is a realistic goal. I should point out real quick, too, that a lot of people, particularly in outdoor recreation, don't agree with this. They want the gung-ho, in-your-face leader and the person that's going to get you all jazzed up and you're going to, you know, get up that mountain or paddle that white water. Mm. And this idea of a leader who's not doing that is not the gung-ho type person, is not always what they want. So
it strikes me, Steve, as sort of what I hear you saying is the difference between motivating and inspiring. When we inspire a team, it seems as motivation is more of an exterior locus of control, and when the motivator leaves, typically the individual or the team is no longer motivated.
Sure.
Whereas the person who inspires and the team or the individual, when the person who has inspired leaves, that there's something still there, so that the performance, continues to improve, or the team continues to grow. And so I guess someone wrote in and said, how do I motivate a team that is always negative? And so what is the leader who is hardly known have to say about motivation? What does the Tao have to teach us about that?
Well, certainly when I do workshops at conferences and stuff, often it's with people who are among them, there's going to be some folks that are probably ropes course facilitators, and often their concern, and I think rightfully so, is that they sometimes have a group for 4 hours, maybe a day,
mm-hmm.
and I realize how fortunate I am to have the same students for a period of a semester, sometimes longer. Because it's obvious to me that this kind of leadership, it is situational. It doesn't work as well in a short period of time where in 4 hours, if you're not going to be the upfront, here's what we're going to do type of leader, nothing's going to get done. It is a transition where the groundwork is laid and people have a sense of what they are to do. What, as you said, what the motivation is, and then trust that if you create activities that are intrinsically satisfying, that over a period of time, people will do things on their own and not have to have the leader hovering over them all the time.
Right, right. Well, so I want to reiterate remind everyone that this is a great opportunity to ask Steve a question about leadership and sort of this Eastern philosophy and this approach to what we're doing with teams and individuals, whether you're a coach, a facilitator, a trainer. Go ahead and raise your hand, your electronic hand, by hitting your one key, and I'll be able to see on this end, so you can get your question answered. And if you're thinking it, it's probably being thought by several people right now in the call. So I want to encourage everyone to do that. Feel free to ask a question either through the dashboard or by raising your electronic hand by hitting your one key on your telephone keypad. Well, go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say, in terms of motivation, too, and this is not a direct answer to the question, but I think I would say humility is probably the most important part of leadership according to a Tao philosophy. But another is often is described as a calm steadiness, but it's an upbeat calm steadiness, meaning that you as a leader are not going up and down constantly as perhaps the people you're working with are going up and down. That you can remain steady and calm through the entire thing, but it's a positive steady and calm. It's often described as stoic, And stoic sometimes has that connotation of being kind of glum, and that's not it at all.
Mm.
And so in terms of motivating people, even though you are in the background, there is an idea that you are continually positive and hoping that sentiment, you know, eventually gets to the group you're working with.
Well, you mentioned the word positive, and I'm struck by the image that many of us know or maybe associate with the Tao, which is the yin yang symbol.
Sure.
Which is, I'm going to guess that most people here on the call are familiar with. It's typically a white image, and it's like intermingling, and it's this idea of tell us what is the relationship, and what is the yin and yang symbol, and what is that? How to teach us, and how is it involved with the Tao and leadership?
Well, the yin and yang symbol is often described as two tadpoles, two tadpoles interlaced with each other, and so there's often there's a dark side and a light side, but then within, it's a circle with a tadpole on one side and a tadpole on the other, but the eye is also there, and the eyes are the opposite color, so where the black tadpole is, there's a white eye. Where the white tadpole is, there's a black eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that signifies that regardless of how much we are one way or the other, there's always the seed of the other in us. A great example is the most macho guy on the planet, you know, holds, he and his wife just had a baby, and he holds his newborn daughter, and he turns into mush, and
mm-hmm.
and you see there is a feminine side or a soft side to this otherwise hard guy. All of us have elements of everything.
Mm-hmm.
The yin and yang, the two terms yin and yang are complementary opposites. Yin is often identified with the feminine side, the softer side, the more flexible side. For leadership, the more reflective side. Yang is more male, more action-oriented, more charge ahead, perhaps more Western or certainly more American is often identified with the yang.
Mm-hmm.
And in the whole notion of the yin and yang is that neither one is right, but neither is finding the center right. It's a constantly shifting perspective, in that each of us need to be both yin and yang, and as a situation dictates, become more of our softer, our more reflective side, or our more action-oriented side.
Hmm.
It's often described, if you're all yin, you're going to be like a tree that's not strong enough to stand up, but if you're all yang, you're going to be so stiff that when the first big storm comes, you're going to get blown over because you can't be flexible when flexibility is called upon.
It's funny that you're relating it like this because Mark Koren writes in and says, how is this philosophy employed in performance reviews? Okay, so here's where the rubber meets the road, Steve, is I've got somebody, let's say I've got somebody on my team, and I have read your book, The Leader Who Is Hardly Known, and I want them to become a stronger leader, a better leader, whatever that is. And so I've read your book, and I go, okay, so this is what a great leader is. And maybe I think in your book you said it's few people will actually live the Tao, but we can begin to get on the path of that. So how does this? I sit down and I start talking with an employee, one of my team members, and I'm responsible for their leadership development. How can I help them?
Okay. Well, one thing about Tao philosophy, particularly as it pertains to leadership, is not there's a term that I probably should have brought up sooner, that there isn't really a good English translation for. It's called Wu Wei. It's often spelled W-U and then W-E-I. And Wu Wei, if you translated it word for word, it would basically be do nothing. But that's not it at all. That's a very wrong interpretation of Wu Wei. Wu Wei is not doing as little as possible. It's doing as little as necessary. And what it means in terms of being a leader, it means that you're always aware of what's going on. You are always prepared to step in when you need to step in, but you prefer not to. If your staff or your participants in your program are proceeding in basically the direction that you want things to go, then you choose to stay out of the way. As soon as you see things that are going in the wrong direction, and in my case, in outdoor recreation, sometimes even in a dangerous way, you know, they're doing something that's not physically safe or emotionally safe, then the leader has to step in. So it's not a laissez-faire where you just go, okay, I'm not going to do anything. It's being there when you need to be there, and that's a pretty important distinction, I think.
So doing as little as possible, so what does that mean for me when I'm coaching a staff or a team member? Are you suggesting that the first place I need to do is question whether I need to help this person or question how much I'm to influence this person on their path?
I guess that's partly right. It's having a strong sense of where you're needed in acting. Another thing, which in terms of performance may not be another part of this whole perspective is accepting good enough sometimes, that perfection is not always what's needed. And in many situations...
Can you give an example of the good enough?
Good enough?
Yeah.
Well, the Tao would say that good enough is better. The cute little analogies they give are numerous. Watering your crops during the rain. I mean that at a certain point you don't need to be there because things would be better if you didn't step in. But it's also accepting that if you are the expert and you are the taskmaster and a number of other things, it's very possible that the end product would be better if you micromanage. But conversely, if you buy into this philosophy, you're going to accept that in some instances perfection is not necessary, and that more has been accomplished by allowing people to do it the way that they see it needs to be done as opposed to the way that you would want to see it to be done. And,
boy, this seems hard, Steve, in a Western philosophy because, you know, I'm sitting here taking notes and I write down the whole concept of over-delivering, under-delivering, delivering, and then over-delivering. And, you know, it seems like, you know, I was at a restaurant with my brother the other day and we were both talking about we had just got done playing a round of disc golf, right? And it was hot and we said, oh, let's go eat lunch. And interestingly, we both had worked in restaurants and at one point in our life, and we were talking about refilling the iced tea,
okay.
Right? So how we were both really thirsty, and you know, I of course wanted to have my iced tea refilled a lot, you know, and just have this person just kind of stay there, ready to pour more iced tea in, and it's this, but it's this whole idea of being there and just, you know, giving more than the customer thinks that they should get. So is that what we're talking about here? Is this the balance of, which seems very American, right? Which is, I don't know. Is that an American thing or is this?
There's another philosopher I'm going to point out, and also another very accessible philosopher, and I think people could actually read him for pleasure. His name is Lin Yutang, L-I-N, and he wrote a book called The Importance of Living. He's deceased now. He died maybe in the 80s or early 90s. But The Importance of Living was basically he was raised in in China, spent time in Europe, in the United States, and then finally settled in Taiwan. And this book is about comparing Asians with Westerners, and particularly Chinese with Americans. And the way he describes it is that he says Americans tend to spend 50% of their time getting it 99% right, and 50% of their time working on that last 1%, and that the Chinese would get it 99% and then go off and do something else. And,
right.
And that's obviously an overgeneralization, but that's, you know, it's not talking about doing a bad job. It's talking about figuring out what's good enough, and then going on and doing something else.
Yeah. Well, it sort of reminds me of the 80-20 rule. You know, they say that 80% of our results are produced from 20% of what we actually are doing.
Sure.
If we divide our day into 100%, and so it seems like that. So what that kind of leads me to this, when you write this book, clearly I'm going to guess that you want to see people change their behavior in how they show up. And so how, when you work with leaders, what is it that you really want them to start doing next, considering that you've written all this whole 50,000 words? I saw that.
Probably,
yeah. So you wrote all this. Where what are we supposed to do now?
Well, I can tell you what I do with my students, and actually I don't have them. One thing, and this maybe goes way back to the religion and spirituality and stuff, but with my own students, I tell some of the legends, but I very seldom, if ever, use the word Tao. I don't talk about Eastern philosophy. What I do with my students when I'm teaching outdoor leadership is to point out to them that everybody doesn't have to be the same kind of leader. That, and many of them do have the notion that they need to be in your face in a positive way, not in your face chewing you out, but that you have to be this enthusiastic, you know, come on, let's go, da 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 kind of leader. Mm-hmm. When for not all of my students is that necessarily their personality, and so I have I'd say relatively introverted or inexperienced people putting on this persona that doesn't come across as genuine. And so I don't, in my classes anyway, I don't offer this as the way they have to do it. I offer it as an alternative to a style that they seem to be already familiar with. We spend a lot of time talking about which kind of people most influence them, and then identifying what type of leadership style those people had, and it runs the gamut. I mean, the people that most influenced my students go all the way, talking about the yin and yang and the complete spectrum, from people that are you know, constantly dominating what's going on and dragging people along with them, to folks that are much more, as we're talking about in terms of Tao philosophy, where it's a quiet, thoughtful, reflective person willing to help when help is needed, but for the most part letting people wander on their own. It's not, now I'm talking very much yin and yang, it's not that there's one kind of leader, it's not that we can even be one kind of leader. We have to have different styles for appropriate situations. It's more introducing this quiet leadership that perhaps is least underrepresented by as you say, the Western perspective of leadership that we tend to think of.
So when you go to Asia, do you is this a common way to look at leadership, or is Asia tending to adopt more of a Western approach? I mean, how, if I was to go to Taiwan, for example, would this be familiar work to many people in business and teams?
I would say largely no. Partly, not certainly business there is fairly westernized, but even a bigger influence is that Lao Tzu and the Tao is not taught that much. I'll say in school, it's not taught that much anywhere. That folks there don't know Taoism any more than most of us know Plato, and it's Confucianism that is the dominant philosophy. It's the basis of their educational system, at least in Taiwan. I'm not as familiar with China, although I think it's basically the same. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who told me, and I'm sure she didn't make this up, but it captures it pretty well. She said that the Taiwanese educational system is in a constant state of confusion. And basically
not
what
confusion,
it,
but Confucian?
Right, like Confucius, yeah.
Yeah, Confucius.
And that is based on the difference is having a great respect for those who are in authority, whether it's your parents or whether it's your supervisors, whether it's your teachers. Certainly as a teacher, I taught for 3 years in Taiwan. It's great. I mean, there's a respect for educators there that 10 times anything I've seen in the United States, and it's certainly nice in terms of how the general population treats teachers and educators. But at the same time, it sometimes is it's work to get students to feel comfortable with questioning their instructors. Mm. And when they start doing it with me, they make it pretty clear that they're doing it with me because I'm an American, and they think that's how American education works. But they'll tell me privately that they would never confront or question their Taiwanese instructors because it's just not the way that things generally are done, and it takes takes an exceptional Taiwanese teacher to create an atmosphere in their classes where students are comfortable with questioning some of the things that the instructor might be saying.
Well, I do want to encourage everyone to read your book, The Leader Who Is Hardly Known, and I'm wondering how you feel about reading the Tao Te Ching. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yep.
As a way to sort of start, or is that, because I've read the latter and the Tao Te Ching, and it can seem like it's easy to understand, but then there's this whole other layer. I feel like it's sort of like I'm swimming on the surface of the ocean, then you can poke your head under the water and go, wow, look at all the other stuff that's going on underneath here. So how is it that someone can pursue understanding this?
My wife's name is Xia Man Yu. She's Taiwanese, when I started writing this book, she gently scoffed at me because she said, "You don't understand the Tao. How can you be writing a book about it?" The more I talk to other people, it's the general belief is that nobody understands the Tao. If we understood the Tao, then life would be very much different. The Tao is often equated to being like a gentle river working its way toward the sea, in that it always seeks the path of least resistance, yet it's one of the most powerful forces in the universe. And most of us don't have that. In fact, the Tao says that human beings don't have that, and that it needs to be a conscious effort to be able to go with the flow. And so in response to your question about whether the Tao Te Ching is something that people can understand, it's both. The Tao, that's the book I would get first. I mean, if you wanted to read, or you don't have to get the book, you can go online and just, there's probably 30, 40 translations of the Tao Te Ching available free online. And
is there a translation that you particularly like?
Yes. I mean, there's a hard copy one that I use. Matter of fact, I just by good chance, I didn't grab it for today, but it's the one I like, so that's the one that's sitting closest to my desk. It's translated by John C.H., those are initials, Wu, W-U, and it's published by Shambhala. But I think the best thing to do is to look at several translations, because they do say different things. They're all, it's what you said. They're all easy to read on a superficial level, and then very complicated when you start reading the same passage over and over again. But the Tao Te Ching is great because you can just flip it open randomly, and there'll be a one-page chapter that'll have something that just about every chapter you'll find something that you think, oh, that's pretty interesting. I can either agree or disagree with that. Earlier I mentioned the Tao of Leadership, which I think the author is Heider, H-E-I-D-E-R. And that would not be a bad place to start either, because it basically what it does is it's his translation, and I don't think he can read the original Mandarin, but he's read a bunch of English translations of the Chinese and has applied it specifically to what does this have to say about contemporary leadership. And so it's one man's interpretation, but again, very short, very crisp, and I think really, really easy to follow. And again, you can choose to agree or disagree with it, but it's not a translation of the Tao Te Ching. It's this guy's interpretation of the Tao Te Ching as it applies to leadership.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. The one of the things that you've created are Qi Ji cards. Is that true?
That's I and some friends have developed some debriefing or processing tools, and one of them is called Qi Ji cards. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I actually own a set of those, and I love those.
Thanks.
I don't think that I use them. I'd like to be around you, watching you use them. For those who haven't seen these cards, they are. It's a card that's like the size of a playing deck, except the card is round, and it has this sort of the yin and yang theme that runs through the whole deck. And so I know, Steve, that you're a master in the area, or at least you're a masterful student in the area of experiential learning. And so can you share with us an activity that around the Tao that we could use perhaps to introduce people or to introduce an idea or that is that somehow involves the Tao with a group of people?
Okay, well, and I'll use the example of the round cards you're describing, although folks don't need to have the cards, that's for sure. But the cards are kind of designed as a yin and yang kind of thing, and there'll be two opposite extremes on the card, and hopefully they're complementary opposites, and they're not stated that one is better than the other, but they're different. Well, we were talking about perfection and good enough is good enough, that one of the cards actually talks working until things are perfect and being satisfied with good enough. There's another card that talks about different leadership styles, that you want to be all the things we've been talking about, that you want to be the leader who's in the forefront and directing things, or you want to be the leader that's out of the picture. And it's a set of I think 48 different complementary opposites. And one of the things that I generally do, and maybe some of your folks do this in different ways already, is to do a human continuum where you read the two complementary opposites, and people can create their own opposites. And the entire group, as individuals, you form a spectrum or a line on the floor of a room, and people have to publicly place themselves somewhere on that line. Are they extremely goal-oriented? Are they extremely process-oriented? Or are they somewhere in between? And people line
so
up.
So on this, you're only talking two phrases here in this particular activity, where the continuum is just this imaginary line on the ground, And at one end, there's one phrase, and at the other end of the line, there's another phrase, and those are sort of polar opposites.
That's correct. And
okay.
people don't have to pick extremes. Matter of fact, very few people do. They can, the spectrum runs from one extreme to the other with a lot of space in between. And I actually usually do it in a horseshoe, so people are always looking at each other, and then they line up where they are, and they can see where they are in reference to the other people in the group, whether they're, and then also, I sometimes ask them then to, if they want to move to where you would like to be, and some people shift and some people stay exactly where they are. I use the same thing with my classes in terms of leadership, where I give them the same thing, these extreme opposites with all kinds of room in the middle, and we talk about where we would like to proceed this semester as we try to develop our, it's a leadership skills course that I'm offering, and I ask the class by looking at these series of things, which, what would they like to work on this semester? If they're very goal-oriented or they're very good at giving concrete instructions for leading activities but feel weak in the reflection or processing aspects of things, well, then we'll work on that this semester. And so it's trying to get the full spectrum, and again, pointing out that there's more than one way to be doing things in terms of how you
what learn. I like about this, and for everyone, is that we're sort of using the concepts of the Tao without talking about the Tao, right? It's not that we have to become students of the Tao necessarily, but we can begin to incorporate teachings, and this is an example of where it's easy. And I've done this particular activity with a group, in fact, with the cards that you mentioned, and it's such a wonderful experience just for people to puzzle and share openly with each other, and then to have a discussion around that. It's a neat experiential way to introduce people to these concepts without saying, okay, turn to page 162, and we're going to discuss that chapter.
I should point out too that I spend a lot of time in Asia. I fell in love with an Asian woman, and I'm still enchanted by that side of the world. But most of these concepts exist in Western writings as well. It's not like the Chinese have the market on these things. I mentioned the Transcendentalist already, which I think is a great example. But even in my field, John Dewey is kind of perceived as the father of experiential education, and I can find some of these concepts in his writings just as well as I can find them in Eastern writings.
Yes, well, that is true. And even current writings, as Ed was mentioning earlier, I'm looking for the comment that he made here. Jim Collins, Good to Great. The level 5 leader is a humble leader. That whole piece is that teachers throughout the ages have been able to communicated the need for humility. And yet, I can say honestly that I still work on that. Because it's sort of like it's tempting, you know, to be at the front and to be an entertainer, I guess.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, and I think that's the path that I've been on is moving. If one end is the entertainer and the other end of the continuum, I don't know what the other end is, but I find it easy to be the entertainer. And so this your book really spoke to me.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier that, you know, about passing the credit over, and I consciously try to do that, but of course it happens all the time where I bask in the glory, I guess. And you know, something happens and they credit me, and if I'm, you know, on top of the game, sort of, I can divert the credit, and if I'm not, I really enjoy getting that. And I don't want to say that, you know, again, not assertiveness trading so much, but folks, you know, if you need the recognition, or if your staff needs the recognition, that's fantastic. But at a certain point, try not to need it, I guess. And I think that's, I know that days later when I realize I passed the credit over, I feel like I did the right thing. Maybe I feel pride, which is what I'm trying to avoid, but I don't know what to do about that one. Yeah.
Well, Steve, tell us, where can we get the book? I should have asked you. I've certainly sent out a link, and I'll send out a link to everyone. During our call, I posted a link to the Wooden Barnes website.
Wooden Barnes, you can certainly go directly to Wooden Barnes, and that would be fine. It's a small publishing company out of Oklahoma City that specializes in experiential education books, and so it's not a bad website to check out to see what else they have. But to be honest, Amazon usually runs it at a discount, and so if you want to do it that way, that's probably the quickest and the cheapest. Conversely, I'd certainly encourage you to support any small mom-and-pop bookstores, but very seldom is it in there. You'd probably have to special order it from a place like that.
Yeah. Well, and so how do people find out more about the work that you're doing?
Actually, going to the Wooden Barn site isn't a bad way to start, I think. I've had 3 books for them. In October, a book specifically on John Dewey will be coming out also through them, and they have a small bio for me there. So that's how you get that information. You can certainly contact me through Wooden Barnes, although you can also contact me directly here at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. I do have a small web page at my university that people can find out the links in terms of getting hold of me and stuff.
Okay, great.
And certainly, you have my email. If people are interested, you can certainly make that available to folks. That's no problem at all.
Okay. Well, I'll post that, and I look forward to your book that's coming out, and about John Dewey, and about the other book, The Processing Pinnacle. I know that many who work in this field, hesitate to say struggle, but we oftentimes are looking for ways to become better at processing or debriefing to make what it is that we are doing stick in a better way. So perhaps I can get you back and we can talk about processing and all that you've learned about processing. Well, maybe not everything, but what we can fit in an hour.
Yeah, no, we can certainly talk about as you say, that book is specifically about processing, not so much activities on processing, but more of a theory-based, if that's quite the right term, but more of a theory-based book on processing, and almost the same as with the Tao book, identifying your style and then taking advantage of that in terms of how you help groups reflect. And that's certainly, it's where I feel like I'm least proficient in terms of effectively processing. And when I see a good, really good facilitator reflecting group, I'm still in awe. But that book does talk about some things to think about in terms of people trying to get better, and also pointing out that sometimes we're better than we think. That a lot of what happens with reflection happens after we're gone or after our participants have left, but the way that we ask the questions or got them thinking before they left is what makes things happen. So I'm sure that a lot of people on the line have the same thing, but some of my most pleasurable emails are ones that I get from students 5-10 years down the road, that say, you know, remember that time with da-da-da-da-da, and sometimes I don't even remember what they were talking about, but it left an impression, and it might have been 4 or 5 years down the road before they realized the value of what had happened at that particular moment.
Right, right. Wow, that's great. Well, Steve, I so appreciate your being here today, and I appreciate everyone else who's been on the call and submitting questions and the opportunity to talk with you. And I want to encourage everyone to go out and get the book, The Leader Who is Hardly Known, Selfless Teaching from the Chinese Tradition. The link to that is at the IATF website, and I'll send out the recording to everyone as well, because I know there are people who missed today's call that had really wanted to be here. So thanks again, Steve.
Oh, you're really welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, for everyone here, again, we've been talking with Stephen Simpson, PhD, the author of The Leader Who is Hardly Known, Selfless Teaching from the Chinese Tradition. And I'm Tom Heck, and look forward to talking with everyone again soon. And I hope you have a great weekend. Bye-bye, everybody.